welcome to a special edition of
the Perth Podcast.
What's the Perth Podcast?
Oh, well, that could be a mystery if you're listening to us on the Culture PK podcast feed.
Which hopefully you are. I'm Ian, and this is...
I'm Stoby.
And we are the Perth Podcast team.
For those of you who are hearing this on the Culture PK feed, the Perth Podcast is a podcast for people living in the Perthshire and Kinrossa area, so make sure to check us out at the Perth Podcast and all your favourite and lesser favourite.
Not so favourite for some of them. We're not on TikTok. We will put our hands up to the fact we are ancient and are not on TikTok.
I don't know what a TikTok is.
Who knows? I see it on TV. TV of all places. But yeah, check us out. The Perth Podcast. We are most places apart from TikTok.
And for those of you listening on the Perth Podcast feed, welcome back.
Yay! You know who we are, probably. Yeah, this is a special edition. This is something we've not really done before, is it? Not like this.
No, this is a good one. So we've been working in association with Culture PK and Perth Museum to talk about the Roman exhibition that's going on in the museum at the moment.
Have we to steer clear of the what have the Romans ever done for us gags?
We did it on the last.
All right, okay, that's fine. That's
good. So
I can do that.
But I am considering what puns to apply to this, like Roman around the museum.
Right. I think on that note, let's just introduce the episode. Should we play the music? People might not have heard this music.
Oh yeah, go for it.
Play the music. So as we say, this is a special edition of the Perth Podcast. We have got together with Mark Hall from Culture PK, who works at the museum. Am I right in saying that you met him? I didn't meet him.
Yeah. So he's a curator of the Roman exhibition going on at the museum at the moment. And I probably couldn't do him justice introducing him. So let's have him introduce himself.
Let's do it.
Over to Mark.
Mark, do it.
Hi there. I'm Mark Hall, and I am a collections officer here at Perth Museum and Art Gallery. I'm trained as a doctor in archaeology, and I've been passionate about archaeology since I was at university in the 1980s, and I've worked here at the museum in Perth since the 1990s, with particular responsibility for looking after the archaeology collection here, and the exhibition that we're in, which is Romans on the Northwest Frontier, the Edge of Empire, we've called it, draws on the archaeology collection here at the museum.
Not going to lie, I hear Doctor of Archaeology and I'm like, Dr. Jones, he's Indiana Jones, he's Perth's version of Indiana Jones.
He was pretty cool, and he knew his stuff.
Did he wear a hat?
We were indoors.
No hat then.
No,
okay,
no
fair
hat.
Enough.
And no whip, but I don't know what to make of that.
Well, leave that with you. So, you were there. Right? Yeah, I can hear you guys were there. So what were you talking about? What happened?
I mean, that was one of the things I wanted to catch as well, was just the acoustics. You know, when you're in the museum, you can, you know, you hear it and you've got that nice echo. So I wanted to catch that and record. So we talked about some of the highlights in the exhibit. He showed me some of the stuff that was going on in there as well. And generally, it was a really quick hour just going over what was in there. And it was really fascinating for me because it has been a while since I've been in there. Shame on me, I know.
And the proper tour as well, with a proper person that knows what they're talking about.
I felt like royalty.
So let's find out what some of the highlights were.
In terms of highlights of objects that have come in, there's really huge numbers. My own particular area of special interest is the medieval period, so anything from Pictish sculpture through to the Lewis chessmen, because my other particular interest is the archaeology of board games, so I'm particularly interested in lots of research on ancient forms of play, and that's a real big interest of mine. And in this exhibition, we probably haven't done a Romans exhibition for something like, I don't know, 20 years or more. And so in that time, we've acquired quite a lot of new and interesting objects, some through excavation projects, some through metal detector finds which have gone through Scottish treasure trove, and so we thought it would be nice to kind of share that new knowledge, as it were, with our visitors, and maybe test out some ideas about how we might understand the Roman period before we create new displays in the new museum that's being developed in Perth, which is probably my key role at the moment, is helping to draw the interpretation and the display process for that project.
That then led me on to the next thing, which was what's going on with the City Hall exhibition.
Yeah, it's obviously, like most things, it's had a minor setback with the COVID-19 pandemic, but we are now kind of full swing ahead again on that project. We're looking to open in 2024, and it involves converting the former City Hall in the centre of town opposite St John's Kirk into a new museum, which will tell the story of the archaeology and history of Perth and Kinross, basically. So it'll be in the centre of Perth, but its reach will encompass the whole of Perth and Kinross. And people will be able to see more archaeology on display there than has ever been shown in nearly 300 years of history of a museum here, because the museum institution, as it were, goes back to the end of the 18th century, when the Literary and Antiquarian Society of Perth was founded, and amongst the earliest things that they collected was archaeology, or antiquarian finds, as they would have called them.
Will that be a Perth-centric exhibition? You know, and will the existing museum stay as it is?
Well, Perth and Kinross, not just Perth. It'll draw on the archaeology and history collections we have to tell that human history story of people who've lived in this area from 10,000 years ago until today, pretty much. Yeah. It's part of a longer-term project, so then this building will still be here. It will become an art gallery, and it will tell that story of artistic endeavour, if you like, as seen through our collections, and then hopefully there'll be a new collection store as well, and that will complement the other two.
Interesting times ahead then for Culture PK and what they can do with two buildings. Or yeah. I know they've got more than that already, but you know what I mean, like moving on from just having the same museum that they've had for a while and be able to spread their stuff around to the different buildings. Awesome.
Yeah, it means they can start to think, well, you know, we've got all this great local stuff, let's get it over to there and show that. And they've got, you know, like you were saying, they're leading the interpretation of the objects at the moment as well. So who knows what's going to come out of that. Yeah. So yeah, it's going to be a fascinating time.
Lots of options, you know, ahead, and probably changeable options too, to keep the interest of the locals as well as visitors.
Absolutely. So one of the things that I'd wanted to ask straight away, but I just took a minute. Well, you know, we talked about why I was actually there, but I wanted to know more about Mark. So I did ask, you know, what got him into the archaeology?
This better be Indiana Jones.
I mean, at school, I was always interested in history. That was probably my favourite subject. But then what really kind of sparked my passion really was I grew up in a place called Stoke-on-Trent, which is down in England, in Staffordshire. And our annual family holidays were invariably in North Wales. And North Wales has some absolutely fantastic medieval castles. And so being able to see those at a sort of young age, between, I don't know, 10 and 14, it was just really inspiring for me. And I was also equally inspired, as lots of people are, by seeing, you know, the ancient past or the medieval past presented on a cinema screen. So films like The Adventures of Robin Hood with Errol Flynn were kind of really kind of inspiring for me as well, you know. And so you get these influences that come from all directions, you know. And then you kind of think, especially with films, was it really like that? How can I find out what it was really like, you know? And that then takes you down the road to university and finding out things in detail, and then, you know, a career in archaeology, and in my case, museum archaeology, because it's always the objects that have appealed to me. You know, there are different ways to do archaeology. Some people like to record buildings, some people like to to dig sites and reveal those buildings and things that are also there. I've always been drawn to the aspects that follow excavation, where the objects have to be looked after and interrogated to see what we can find out about how people used to live.
When we were talking about that, and he's talking about, you know, the interpretation of the items, and it's like, it isn't just, this is this item, and here's what it does. You know, you have got to put it into context. You've got to have the knowledge. And that's one of the things I was then saying, you know, to him was, I'm really liking the idea that I'd never thought about, but the detective work part of it.
And I think a lot of people, that's what appeals to a lot of people. And that's why things like, you know, metal detecting is such a popular hobby, because for lots of people that puts them directly in touch with the past, you know, and they won't, and it makes it sort of tangible. And that's the thing that objects do. You know, you could come to a museum and have a gallery just full of kind of reconstruction imagery or digital reconstructions, and those are always useful to kind of giving people a sense of what things might have been like. But it actually, to stand in front of the actual objects that were in people's hands 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, and more, I don't think you can really beat that.
I totally get the passion for that sort of idea. You know, every day is different. Every possibility changes every day as well. I mean, you talk about history, you talk about dating of old items, and it changes all the time because the science behind how we date things changes mm-hmm. all the time. And, you know, science is about allowing the change, not denying the fact we might have got it slightly wrong the first time mm-hmm. or whatever. And it's that ability to adapt and change is where the real skill is, isn't it? To accept the fact that maybe you were wrong the first time. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, I remember seeing a quote before about how scientists are never right. They're always wrong, or they're always looking to prove themselves wrong. Yeah. They're right until they're proved wrong. Mm-hmm. And that's what it comes down to. And the proof is out there. And it must be fascinating to turn around and go, I'm holding a vase that an Egyptian held in their hand however many thousands of years ago. That's incredible. I totally get why people get into this role.
And the other thing is that you've got the idea that I find quite exciting of, like, this one item, this one discovery has just disproved everything we knew, and we have to rethink it all. Yeah. I like that as well. One of the things I was saying as well was just, we were talking about the age of the items and how old they are, and it's actually quite hard to get your head around that at times. Because if you think of, like, an ancient item, might think of like a CRT TV.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
10 years ago.
Or a dance album from 1991.
A CD. And these some of these items are hundreds of years old, yeah. You know, and it's just this.
Do you want to hold it? No.
No, I barely want to look
you,
at it.
You hold it, I won't breathe in it. There we go.
So then, yeah, what I'd said to Mark was basically that exact same thing, where it's hard to get your head around the age of an item and how long it has actually been here.
Yeah, exactly. And for really young kids as well, you know, they're, to them, ancient is like granny, you know, or granddad, or, you know. So that's one of the hardest things, is to get over the age of things and the amount of time that has passed, you know. And so one of the things we try to do in this exhibition is to make it accessible for really young kids as well. So we have different levels of labeling so that it's very easy for young kids, and then there's a bit more information for adults and the normal visitors that we get.
After we talked about that, I then did dive into the, okay, tell me about the Roman exhibition. Let's get into it. Let's have a proper look at this exhibition now.
We are sort of standing at the end of the exhibition, and people will come in at the far end of the gallery there, what happens right at the start of the exhibition is we put it in context and show how this part of the world, what today we call, you know, Perth and Kinross, fitted into ancient Britain, and how ancient Britain fitted into the Roman Empire. There's a fantastic map up there which shows the sort of maximum extent of the empire in the mid second century AD, when it covered kind of most of Europe, North Africa, the Middle East, and covered something like 1 million square miles, I think someone has calculated. So it's a huge, you know. And empires are really interesting. We're living in a time where we're starting to reevaluate our own sense of what empire was, with the kind of fading of the British Empire and people questioning what that really meant for people. Well, one of the ways we can do that is by looking at other empires, and the Roman Empire is a really good example to kind of draw contrasts from. And because it's never so straightforward as being a sort of an empire and the colonized, in this exhibition we try to compare and contrast kind of Roman ways of doing things with Celtic or British ways of doing things. So we look at some set themes like everyday life or supernatural beliefs, and we look at what the Romans thought, and we look at what the ancient Britons thought, and often we find that, you know, they came close together, you know. So objects which we think of as Roman, we often find on British sites, and sometimes we find British styles of things clearly being adapted by Roman soldiers to use as part of their kit. So there's this intermingling of identities. It's not a straightforward thing to say someone's a Roman and someone's a Briton or a Celt or whatever, you know. And the Roman Empire, it's huge. It encompasses loads of different peoples from the known world. So to say someone was a Roman, you know, doesn't mean they came from Rome. Mm-hmm. So you've got that complexity of cultural practices all intermingling whenever the Roman army moves into new territory. This is on through till February of next year, so there's still, you know, plenty of time for people to come and see it. It's free to come in, but we really value people's support. Yeah. We've got several donation boxes scattered around, and I'd have to just say how difficult things have been with the lockdown and all the rest of it. So if people can support us in that way by giving us a donation, we really appreciate it.
Now, that sounds fascinating. Tons and tons of stuff going on. And my daughter loves going to museums. It looks like I need to grab her and head back down there at some point.
Well, like he says, it's only on until next month now. So get a move on.
Get a move on.
One of the things that popped into my head again, and it's just, you don't think about it until you're in that situation, you start discussing it, was the fact that the term Roman is very loose. Is it a person? Is it a culture? Is it a time period?
Multiple meanings.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And that's what I said to him. I was like, yeah, actually, when you think on it, the term Roman doesn't just refer to a time period.
There are many ways you could interpret the label Roman, but when you try to really drill down to see how interactions work between different peoples, you've got to really kind of realize that that's just a kind of superficial label, really, and interactions are about complex human behavior, not simple one-word labels, you know.
I'm assuming at some point, Stoby, you asked him, is he a member of the People's Front of Judea or the People Judea's Front?
I have no idea what that is.
Have you never seen Monty Python?
No. Yeah, years ago, I had a fever. It was the worst film to watch when I had a fever.
Life of Brian, mate. That's your homework.
Right, okay.
Anyway, what else did you talk about?
Well, after that, we went into actually some of the detail about the exhibits themselves.
The first selection I would talk, actually where we are, there are two cases of objects which are all excavated from the same site, which is a place known as Castle Craig, which is in Strathern, between sort of Dunning and Auchterarder. And this is a Caledonian or British site, but lots of really nice Roman goods found there. So, for example, we have this Roman saucepan, which is a typical piece of Roman kit, which each unit of three Roman soldiers would have as part of their daily cooking equipment. But obviously these were then liked, either soldiers traded them or they were taken, or the many different ways in which these things can swap hands, and it got into the Caledonian site at Castle Craig. And it's one of several that we have. I'll take you through into, in some ways, an even nicer example. is this one here, which is not complete. It's in two parts. And this was found in the early 19th century at a place called Stormont Loch, which is near Blairgowrie. It was dredged out of the loch when they were lowering the water level of the loch for agriculture. And again, what's really interesting about this is you can't see it in detail here, but there are bits of patchwork on it which show that it was repaired over time and reused. So something that kind of came out of Roman possession into Caledonian possession and was a highly valued object, and probably used in a different way by the Caledonians. And it's interesting to think of them being used with my favourite object in the exhibition, this huge cauldron, which was found at Abercairny, again in Strathern. And you can imagine saucepans like that and the one from Castle Craig being dipped in here if it's full of either some kind of soup or casserole, or even better if it's full of wine or beer, and then distributing that drink out into cups. And we know they had those. We've got several examples of tankard handles here, so we know feasting and celebrating was an important communal activity, and this cauldron really kind of points to that. And again, it's also just brilliantly made from a single piece of sheet bronze, which they then hammer and beat into shape to get this lovely curvature to it. And if you look closely at it, you can see that pattern that it has. That's all the bronze workers hammering marks, which gives it that distinctive patina and pattern rather than patina. Then on a smaller scale, we have really nice things like the object in this case at the back with the two loops and the coloured enamel centre is part of horse harness fitting, which kind of distributed straps that the rider would use to kind of just basically ride the horse. But what's really interesting about this is that it was found very close to Carpu Roman Fort, down near Abernethy, and it clearly, I think, being used as a piece of Roman military equipment. But all that style of enamelling is what's known as the massive style. It's a very typical North British indigenous style of decoration that's common in northeast Scotland. And so again, that shows us that these objects were moving around from Roman to Caledonian, from Caledonian to Roman as well. It wasn't all kind of one-way traffic. And there are several really nice metalwork objects in this exhibition which have that same kind of decorative style and help to kind of reinforce that idea of Caledonian stuff being used by Romans as much as the other way around. And then probably if I picked out one more object, two objects actually, from this selection of dress fittings that we have. One is this really massive brooch here, which lacks its pin, but would have been used as a dress fastening. It would have been worn just off the shoulder here. And it's the kind of brooch that's in that same massive style. It was very typical of dress fittings that women wore. But this thing is absolutely enormous. They're not normally that size. If you look at the one above, that's the normal size. So this is indicating that someone was really important, had a lot of status, and was female. And so it helps us to remember that this is just not just about the guys. It's the women as well who were powerful and important at this period. And then next to it, we have a much plainer looking brooch, what's known as a crossbow brooch, because it looks in miniature like a crossbow, basically. And when that came in as a metal detector find, it was quite kind of encrusted with soil and what have you, and so it looked like just a simple brooch of copper alloy, and whilst it is made of copper alloy, when we had it cleaned for this exhibition, we picked up traces of gold plating on it. So we know then that it's These are very rare form of a brooch that was given to high status Roman officials. We think that would be the case with this one, rather than it being some sort of kind of copy maybe, because we now know it was finished in gold.
Yeah.
So it would have been really important to the person who was wearing it and signalled that that person had power and authority.
After going in and looking at these exhibits, and this was just some. This was just a few items. This wasn't, you know, there was so much there. Each cabinet had multiple items sitting in there, and they were sitting in groups. Lots. But one of the things we came back to was just the what we were talking about before, the detective work, the slotting each find into the bigger picture.
And of course, you have to kind of slot it into the jigsaw puzzle, so you have to know about the other examples that have been found and the different forms that things like this take, and there's a huge kind of matrix of information out there, and every time we find something new, we're kind of trying to fit it into that and see what it means for that new object, but also what that new object tells us something new maybe about the stuff we already knew about it, you know. So it's constantly changing picture as we find out new things and look to find out new things.
That is the bigger picture is huge, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Like that is such a big statement, the bigger picture. And you could find one item that throws everything else out the window that you maybe pieced together or thought beforehand. Because at the end of the day, it's guesswork, but it's educated guesswork. Mm-hmm. But one item, I mean, look at the dinosaurs, redating the dinosaurs. And the fact that, you know, I think all our dinosaur toys are covered in scales, but actually I think scientists are thinking they were feathered now, but it's too late.
Jurassic Park was made. I've actually just finished reading Jurassic Park, the novel.
Right.
And a lot of the book is about, you know, Dr. Grant thinking, well, actually, you know, this is what we thought, but we never actually knew. And this is fascinating to see. And even then, what's portrayed in that is just out guesswork. But yeah, I mean, slotting it all into the bigger picture and what he was showing me, I just thought, you know, I actually said to him, you know, for lack of a better term, this is really cool.
It is really cool. A lot of the objects in here, you know, are really cool. And I think if people can have that reaction to these objects, I think that's fantastic.
Where we were standing at that point, I was kind of distracted because there was these many what I thought were like trebuchets there.
And fire in the hole!
I genuinely was so tempted while he was talking just to start leaning over. And
How did the pot break, Mr. Toby?
Well, they were just mini ones. So I did point out that actually, you know, there is, for kids, you know, you don't take kids to a museum in the same way you take kids to a park. But, you know, it's still great for them to go to, and there are things for them to get involved in. And I just kind of pointed out at that point, and I see you've got some stuff for the kids as well.
Roman military, the equipment they can dress up in, you know, with helmets and shields and some clothes and swords. And then, as a bit of fun, really, we've got these scaled down versions of Roman military equipment, a ballista and what's known as an onager, which is a form of catapult,
right.
And people can try and hit the various targets, and there were scores we put on as Roman numerals. I doubt if anyone's ever reached the top one. I can't imagine that these would actually reach up there, but kids are clearly having fun with this, because we've actually replaced these once already, because they've had so much use, it's kind of worn them out. So, and that's great if kids are engaging with it that way.
Yeah.
And then they can look at sort of the Roman tent here that we have with some other equipment in that unfortunately can't get in here, but it gives them a sense of the typical soldiers' accommodation when they were out on campaign. Mm-hmm. and they had to live in tents. This would be a slightly bigger tent than it's shown in here, and you'd probably get eight men in it. And then this, you know, this is where they'd use those saucepans. They'd have a charcoal or coal fire in here, and that's where they would do their...
So there's like adult-sized helmets, yeah? Yeah? This isn't just for the kids, is it?
I brought you one.
As long as you brought me one of these flasks or whatever, so you can drink out of, you know, the big ones. No, nothing like that. No, that's a shame.
Coming back to what, you know, earlier on I'd asked Mark what got him into archaeology, Then asked, you know, on the subject of kids, you know, kids might come along, get inspired by this in the same way he was inspired.
Not by Indiana Jones, it turns out.
No, not by Indiana Jones. But,
I'm not letting that go.
There's a new generation. So it was case, like, I did ask, how do you get into this field of work?
Archaeology covers a massive wealth, a massive range, of subjects. So it really depends on what people are interested in. And of course, if they go to university, they'll get a taste of all those different areas. You know, you can go from very heavily science based work, which is looking at things like DNA and isotopes to understand ancient populations and where they were coming from and what sort of things they were eating and what sort of things they were dying from, through to looking at artifacts and understanding how they were made and how they worked, to operating the latest high-tech kit out in the field to record sites and things like that. So there's a kind of a myriad of possibilities, I guess most of us, the route that we go in some way or shape or form is to go to university and study there, but we might combine that with doing voluntary work either on an excavation, sometimes in a museum, and there are other things that you can do like that. Yeah, it's much better known these days as a subject, and even it in some schools, kids can do archaeology. There is a curriculum for that in parts of the UK, and of course the curriculum varies from each UK nation to the next. But it is I think it still is available to study. I know the A-level curriculum in England was recently scrapped, but nevertheless, there are ways you can approach it, and you don't, to do archaeology at university, you don't need to have done archaeology at school. You could just need to be interested in it and have the right level of qualifications to sort of get in, you know.
What else is there for kids?
Well, there's another piece which is quite interactive, not necessarily for kids, it's for all ages,
right.
Is this map. And again, Mark can explain it way better, but it was really quite interesting, and it's got future potential as well. You know, it's not specific to this exhibition.
Well, the other thing as well that people might like is we've devised this interactive map here that people can use to look at the different phases of Roman interaction in this area. So it tells you, and you can see from these labels that it gives you different episodes, so you can see when the Romans first arrive here, how the campaign goes, what some of the indigenous sites are, and when the last campaign is, which is in the early 3rd century. And this is a new departure for us. And the map is based on 3D printing, with then projecting the topography onto it. So it's a kind of experiment for us, but it worked quite well, I think.
Mm-hmm. And it'll work for more than just the Roman exhibit. It'll work for any kind of.
Well, the approach, yeah. I mean, you know, you and that base map, we could project any number of things onto that from any period, really, because that's just shows you the geography of Perth and Kinross. But and it depends what people want out of the exhibition. They don't have to come and read every label. They can use the junior labels if they want, which is much shorter, or they can just come and kind of admire the objects if they want to, you know, and come back another time to read the text. It's really up to them how they break it down and take it on board. And we also have on selected objects we have these QR codes and they just for a selected half dozen objects give a much more detailed stud account of those objects, more than you would want to put onto a label, but which tell nice stories for people to listen to.
We were getting close to wrapping up. We'd gone over the exhibit, we'd talked about a lot of things, but there's still some things I wanted to hear about. Yeah, I was proper into like visitor mode at this point now. I was forgetting about the podcast. I'm like, what is this over here? What's that?
Mark's looking at his watch going, it's been 3 hours. Would you go home?
And when I was recording, it got cut out, but actually the bell that rings that says, right, everyone, get out, actually rang. So
take the hint.
We did get to that point. But yeah, I pointed out there was a really cool stone face. I wanted to know a bit more about.
Yeah, he's from Perth. It's the head of probably a ritual statue, which would have been placed at a shrine, probably on the North Inch. It probably represents a Celtic god, and kind of is a sort of contrast to the altar stone that we have over here. This comes from the fort at Bertha, which is also at the far end of the North Inch. That was found on the North Inch, but they illustrate the kind of interconnectivity, really, of native and Roman religion. Rome was very tolerant of people's religious beliefs, as long as whatever belief you practiced, you recognised that the Roman emperor was to be recognised as a god, you know. the Roman military would all have had this kind of altar, because that's where they would have taken their oaths to the Roman emperor as the head of the army, but also in recognition that the emperor was a god. Mm-hmm. So it's got an inscription in Latin which just says Disciplinae Augusti, so to the discipline of the Roman emperor. But you know, these things were kind of interchangeable. People could follow multiple religions if they want to, or only one. Where Rome got into conflict was when it came up against religions which wouldn't toe that kind of Roman line. Mm-hmm. And particular examples are the Jewish faith and early Christianity. This altar, for example, was found in the 1950s, early 60s by two schoolboys. And it was found in the bank of the River Almond, which is the fort, sits just on the edge of an area of flat ground that's bounded by the River Almond and the River Tay. So we know it came from the fort because it's just outside it.
Could you imagine just being like one of these two schoolboys that just finds this
thing in the river?
That's not a normal stone.
Imagine going home to their parents like, oh, shut up, don't talk nonsense. No, really, there was a face on it.
and as we started to wrap up, one of the last things we talked about was Bertha Fort, which was in the video. So they've got a video on display, but you'll hear Mark talk about that.
There is stuff underground there. You can see aerial photography, and it's certainly, although the Roman kind of episode in this part of the world was relatively short, it only lasted intermittently for a few decades, but it has left some kind of magnificent monuments in terms of Roman forts and fortlets, which is just smaller forts, and things like camps or marching camps, and it includes and people might hear noise in the background. About a fort at Ardoch, which again is in Strathearn, and is down near a place called Braco. And this is one of the best preserved earthwork Roman forts absolutely anywhere, not just in Scotland, but just the whole Roman Empire. And we've got a really interesting film that explains what you can see on the ground there and how its story develops.
And that was it. That was all we had time for. Like I say, the bell rang and I had to get out. So
the beat it bell. What do you mean? Snowby, beat it.
Get out. And that was it. So I had a fantastic time. I suddenly realised that like an hour wasn't long enough, but I was working that day as well. You know what I mean? So it was tight schedules.
And he probably had better things to do than give you a personal tour of the museum.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
It's not every day people get that.
However, it was absolutely fascinating. Mark, thank you.
Yeah, massive thank you to Mark for taking a time out of his day to, you know, take this clown around the museum. But no, it sounds really interesting. And as Toby says, there's not a lot of time left, folks. So yeah, there's only a few weeks left, folks, to go and see this one. It's on until the 6th of February at Perth Museum and Art Gallery.
So once again, thank you, Mark. It was fascinating. Really appreciate your time. For those of you listening on the Culture PK feed, like we said at the start, check us out. Give us a wee like, subscribe, tell your friends.
The Perth Podcast. Find us, like us, and stuff. What are the other buttons? Follow and things. We're dead good at this.
Yeah, it's almost like we've practiced over 31 episodes.
I know, 31 episodes. But check out the back catalogue as well of Perth Podcasts, and definitely subscribe to the museum one if you're just listening to this on the Perth Podcast as well. Check out the Perth Museum Culture PK podcast as well. Beyond that, though, I think our special is done. Our work here, it is done.
It is indeed. Thanks for listening, everyone. Until next time.
Ciao!